The Sunstone Foundation presents Are You What You Read? The Implied Reader in Church and Quasi-Church Publications, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel Utah in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Our speaker today is Doris Williams Elliott. She received her BA in English at BYU and is currently working on her master's in English in British literature at the U of U, and that will be completed this fall. She has taught high school and junior high school English and journalism in Salt Lake and also in New York for 7 years, and she's currently an instructor in English at the BYU Salt Lake Extension. The respondent is Douglas Thayer. He is a professor of English at BYU, the director of composition, the author of numerous works, including the Under the Cottonwoods and Other Mormon Stories, Summer Fire, and he's currently working on a collection entitled Wasatch. I'd like to turn the time over to Doris at this time. Thank you for being with us.
Recently, a new acquaintance of mine who was searching for words to describe her husband finally blurted out, "Well, he's not the type that would ever read a Sunstone all the way through." And many of us in the church, consciously or not, make judgments about people and their religious attitudes according to which church or church-related publications they read and respect. Now, what allows us to make these judgments is an intuitive sense of the implied readers of those publications. And this is probably the... I've been frustrated in a couple of sessions by people who used terms that I wasn't entirely familiar with, and so I just put this up here to maybe give you a little visual explanation of what I'm talking about. The term implied reader is borrowed from the study of narrative theory. It refers not to any actual live reader or group of readers, but to a construct of characteristics that are encoded within a text. The implied reader cannot be gleaned from either surveys of readership or conversations with any real readers because all actual readers are outside of the text. The implied reader has a given set of characteristics, attitudes, and presuppositions which is relatively stable. When an actual reader approaches any given text, he sheds some of his own attitudes and characteristics and theoretically selects only those which will enable him to become temporarily this implied reader. The reader which is implied or intended by the text. Now, Wayne Booth calls this contract between the actual and implied reader's suspension of belief. Of course, this theoretical complete agreement between the author's implied reader and the real reader never actually occurs. In fact, it may yield a more interesting reading if the real reader does not agree with the role prescribed for him by the implied reader in the text, because each real reader reads differently, interpreting or, in a sense, rewriting the text as he reads. If a real reader consciously and voluntarily refuses to take on his role as sympathetic implied reader, he is able to view the text from a detached, even analytical standpoint. If he cannot take on that role, however, he will likely feel uncomfortable reading the text, experiencing lack of understanding and or identification. Rather than being drawn into the text, he will remain outside. Now, if the text happens to be an official or unofficial publication closely related to a specific group or ideology, such as the LDS Church, the actual reader's relation to the reader implied by the publication can even partially condition his responses to the group itself. We've probably all had the experience of reading a book or some other type of publication which seemed somehow just not to click for us. Now, I had such an experience a few years ago reading Saul Bellow's Henderson the Rain King. I knew the book was well written and it was significant, it was humorous, but I simply couldn't enjoy it like I felt I ought to, much to the disappointment of the friend who shared his copy with me. Later, when I encountered the concept of the implied reader in a graduate class, it occurred to me that the implied reader of Henderson the Rain King is distinctively male. And it occurred to me that perhaps my difficulty in fully relating to the story was that I was female, and my experiences had not prepared me to adopt the stance of the implied reader of that book. In other words, it wasn't written for me. It was written for my husband, who loved the book, and most men who I've ever talked to did. The concept of the implied reader may be even more significant applied to periodicals than it is to narrative fiction. While an author writing a novel or story probably somewhat vaguely imagines an ideal reader to whom he addresses his writing, for the editor faced with the necessity of marketing a magazine, the reader is a real and present force. The editor uses his notions about his real audience to make editorial decisions about what will appear in his publication. In a sense, the real reader creates the text. But the text itself still contains an implied reader who is separate from those readers. Usually, the implied reader of a magazine, journal, or newspaper is fairly close to the majority of the publication's actual readers. But occasionally, the implied reader perceivable in the text differs from the readers the editor and writer think they are writing for. Thus, being able to identify the implied reader encoded in a text could be useful to an editor or writer as well as to the reader approaching the text. Well, how then do we construct or identify this implied reader, particularly in texts such as church periodicals? Daniel Wilson defines the implied reader as the behavior, attitudes, and background necessary for a proper understanding of the text. In other words, what the text assumes about the knowledge, beliefs, and abilities of its implied reader. For the remainder of this paper, I will explain a taxonomy of characteristics of implied readers using six church and church-related periodicals for my examples and discuss the implications approaching these publications from the standpoint of the implied reader. Now, I'm going to show you the publications that I've examined so that you'll recognize them. If you probably read some of them. I chose the Anson from March 1985. This is what it looks like. The Church News, somewhere, this one. That's from May 1985. This People, May 1985 issue. The Exponent 2 from Winter 1985. Sunstone, March 1985. And Dialogue from Spring 1985. Now, I might explain to you that in doing this study and preparing this paper, I had 40-plus pages just skimming the surface of the things that I observed from reading these journals and magazines. And you're not going to get very much of that today, but maybe you can think about it, particularly if you've read any of these specific issues, that you may come up with some of your own ideas about them. The most basic assumptions any text makes about its implied reader concern language of nationality, general linguistic competence in using that language or languages, and understanding and recognition of connotative language. The length of sentences, the complexity of syntax, and the level of vocabulary are some indicators of the implied reader's linguistic abilities. Now, please note the handout, which I hope most of you got, for some examples of the level of vocabulary used in the six publications. The Church News, you'll note, implies the lowest level of linguistic competence. Church News articles frequently employ cliches and overworked words such as fine, wonderful, precious, sweet, and so forth, while avoiding multisyllabic or difficult words. The Ensign's vocabulary is similar, though perhaps slightly more sophisticated. This People uses a curious mix of educated vocabulary and extremely colloquial expressions like what do you think and a unique bunch of people. Exponent 2, Sunstone, and Dialogue all assume a much higher level of linguistic competence in both vocabulary and syntax. Not surprisingly, Dialogue tallies the highest number of specialized or scholarly terms, including some probably not readily understood by most college-educated readers. With an MA in English, I had to look up six words in the dictionary and to find out what they meant. A text always encodes numerous cultural phenomena, which the implied reader is expected to know. At the most basic level, as Jonathan Culler points out in Structuralist Poetics, is the socially given text, that which is taken as the real world. The Exponent 2 story, One Woe Is Past, depends for effect on two such real-world assumptions concerning cockroaches. One, that cockroaches are repellent. But also on the other hand, that anyone who is so afraid of cockroaches that she dreams about them, sees them multiplying beyond reason, and imagines them with faces cunning and communicative, is somehow unbalanced and not normal, because such experiences with cockroaches are not real. So that's what I'm talking about when I say real-world assumptions about what we take as the real world. All implied readers also function within the conventions of smaller subcultures, such as 20th century American, Utah Mormon, 19th century Mormon, Illinois, and so on. The implied readers of the six church-related publications share a familiarity with 20th century American culture as well as the Mormon subculture. There are, however, subtle differences in the level of cultural understanding in the readers of these works. The Ensign, for example, carries a news story on the success of the BYU football team in which the following appears. For those who simply have an allegiance to BYU but have difficulty following the intricacies of North American football, this implies a reader not totally familiar with what we call 20th century American culture. Another article in that Ensign, however, refers to Mormon Standard Time, which presumes a fairly intimate knowledge of a subculture, which is not entirely delineated by national boundaries. Some texts also require an educated reader who has acquired knowledge in a number of disciplines unrelated to the subculture, science, geography, literature, history, and so forth. One signal that such an educated reader is needed is the presence of unexplained allusions. And again, note the handout of unexplained allusions, of some samples from the six church-related publications, and what they require in terms of education and experience in their implied readers. The church news geared to a general newspaper-level reader has virtually no unexplained allusions. The Ensign uses only a few common references. This People, however, includes a few common literary allusions, a number of scientific concepts, and a wide variety of allusions to popular culture. The other three publications, not unexpectedly, contain numerous unexplained allusions from contemporary culture, literature, history, music, and philosophy. Not many, however, from science, which I found rather interesting. There were more in This People related to science than in any of those publications. Besides determining the level of an implied reader's linguistic competence and his understanding of the cultural codes, we must also look at his general reading abilities, which I call literary competence. By this, I mean the ability to make inferences, to recognize symbols and metaphors, to sift the important from unimportant details, to anticipate and recollect, in short, to perform a number of mental operations necessary to the process of reading. Although these operations are necessary in reading non-fictional magazine articles, the level of competence of the implied reader is more readily identifiable in the fiction or poetry sections, because fiction and poetry generally involve some effort on the part of the reader to fit together images, characters, metaphors, plot details, and or emotions to form some pattern of meaning. In a nonfiction piece, the meaning is usually displayed more systematically. The more complicated the intellectual maneuvers necessary to unraveling the text are, the higher the level of competence expected of the implied reader. The implied reader who can go beyond the kinds of skills required of the reader of popular fiction, which is about the level of the Ensign reader, to perform the mental operations required in more open-ended pieces, such as some printed in Exponent 2, Sunstone, and Dialogue, has a higher level of literary competence than one who must have all meanings spelled out. Now, although a number of critics have faulted Wayne Booth, and some of you may know of Wayne Booth, he's also a local boy made good at the University of Chicago, a very major American critic from American Fork. But although a number of critics have faulted Wayne Booth for his insistence that the implied reader has a definite set of moral and or religious beliefs which the actual reader must share at least temporarily in order for a reading to be successful, his discussion of the implied reader's beliefs is very relevant in comparing readers of church and quasi-church publications. Although these implied readers share beliefs related to the Mormon religion at some basic level, the differences in belief among them are significant in separating them from each other. Religious beliefs and attendant values are discernible in almost every statement made in the six church-related magazines. Obviously, a statement like, "As parents, we want our children to grow up to be humble and obedient to the laws of God," which is from the Ensign, is a clear statement of a belief the implied reader holds. But even a negative statement can be a statement of belief. Another Ensign article says, "For weeks I had felt increasingly unable to cope with numerous personal commitments and still give my family the quality time they needed," which implies that the reader believes that righteous women should be able to cope with numerous personal commitments and still be a superior mother. Exponent 2, however, assumes that its readers may not share this belief. One article describes a family in which the mother is able to follow her career goals because her husband fulfills many of the mothering responsibilities. And incidentally, each of the implied readers of the six church-related publications tends to have favorite or pet doctrines which they like to have discussed frequently. And they all occasionally challenge the pets of the other, and when you start tracing them, it gets very interesting. One of Exponent 2's pet subjects, for instance, is the existence and character of Heavenly Mother, a topic that is not often addressed in the other publications. Obviously, although readers of these publications share some basic beliefs, they also differ rather widely. It is crucial to an understanding of the implied readers here discussed to recognize the beliefs and values assumed by each text, whether those beliefs are stated blatantly, stated in the negative, or only suggested obliquely through figures held up as models, articles selected or not selected for publication, and types of authorities cited. And I might also add, although this information is not generally available to the public, and that's which portions of articles submitted are cut out, which is edited out, which is also a standard practice in publishing, and can tell you something about the implied reader as well. Not only beliefs, however, but attitudes toward belief go into the construction of the implied reader. Does this reader see his belief system as stable and solid, his only task being to put his beliefs into practice? Or is belief something rather to be continually examined in light of continued life experiences and new learning? We commonly assume that the Ensign takes a conservative approach to belief, while Sunstone and Dialogue readers are more open to questioning. A careful reader should be cautious about oversimplifying, though. The Ensign, despite its generally literal-minded attitude toward belief, does some tentative exploration. An article on a New Testament passage discusses three alternative interpretations by non-Mormon biblical commentators, cites examples of church authorities who have preached each interpretation, putting them in conflict with each other, and leaves the correct choice to the reader, with a final reminder, however, that the passage's moral meaning is clear in any case. But such slight challenges to accepted beliefs and values are certainly few and tentative. The implied reader of the Ensign would presumably be quite shaken if any blatant challenging or exploring were expected of him. In general, Ensign articles feature doing rather than knowing or thinking. Orthodox belief is assumed in the implied reader. What he wants from his reading is motivation and instructions to help him apply those beliefs. Now, more basic even than a reader's belief system is his mindset. Does the reader approach a text straightforwardly, taking things at face value, or is he suspicious or sharply inquisitive? Is he optimistic, pessimistic, or cynical? Does he have a sense of playfulness and a sense of humor? If so, on what level? Does he laugh mostly at broad humor, or does he appreciate dry wit and veiled ironies? Is he tolerant of ambiguity, or must he have solutions to all problems or paradoxes? Is he dutiful and inclined to follow rules, or rebellious and likely to be contrary or play devil's advocate? Is he tolerant of difference, locally focused, or interested in other cultures and value systems? What is his relationship to the world outside the subculture? Is he sentimental? Does he have a sense of the past and value it? Is he a loner, or does he prefer a feeling of community? Is he family-centered or individually focused? Is he economically well-off or not? And is he or she male or female? What I've given you so far is a sampling of the kinds of traits and abilities of an implied reader which are built into a text. The list of traits I have described is by no means exhaustive, but it should give you an idea of how we go about consciously constructing this implied reader when we approach a text. Now, using the taxonomy I have outlined, it's possible to construct an implied reader profile for each of the six church and quasi-church publications, and that's what I'll do for the remainder of this paper. The implied reader of the Ensign, as I read it, is female. The shortage of actual doctrinal pieces, which by tradition women would be less interested in, the number of personal confession-type articles usually written by women, and the frequency of how-to articles on raising children and homemaking hints would seem to imply a female reader. Articles of this type are typical of the female discourse of traditional women's magazines. Even the words and imagery used in titles is traditionally female. Of 9 titles in this March issue, 3 use the word love, 2 use the word child, 3 relate to gardening, and 3 use needlework images. This implied reader tends to approach the text straightforwardly, accepting what she reads at face value without applying a great deal of thought to her reading, hence the questions at the end of some articles reminiscent of high school textbooks. And even though the Ensign is primarily a subscriber publication with a captive audience, the format and design imply that the reader's attention needs to be caught. The Ensign uses glossy photos, well-designed illustrations, and kickers or call-outs to get the reader into the articles, implying a reader who needs to be pulled through and encouraged to read clear through the magazine. Since the magazine's purpose is instructional more than simply informational, the implied reader must be guided in her reading. The Ensign reader, in fact, is essentially a non-reader, too busy or not interested in reading that is not immediately useful or perhaps inspirational. The Ensign reader does have a sense of humor. She likes obvious puns, clever turns of phrase, and humorous situations, especially those involving children and missionaries. Her economic level is middle or upper middle class, and note particularly, I know most of you can't see this, but maybe you'll recognize it, but note the cover of this issue particularly. The dress and the home and are clearly upper middle class. Although she does try to economize and conserve because she values thriftiness. She is, of course, family-centered, and the church is her major outside interest. Service is rendered to family and neighbors. And he's still here. Okay. And she has little relationship to the outside larger world, which is seen as the enemy. The church newsreader, is there anybody who knows anything about these here? All right. Well, we'll just hang on. The church newsreader is similar to the Ensign's. He or she, I probably should say, is on a slightly lower economic level, has less experience with the church, has a shorter attention span, is a little less educated, and is perhaps even more conventional. The church newsreader is locally focused, so the church news frequently runs features complete with expensive color photographs of Mormons in other cultures, foreigners who are usually shown to be both Mormonized and Americanized. The Mexican couple with the baby on the cover of this church news, for example, is obviously upper middle class. The man is, in fact, as we read inside, a doctor. And they look much like any prosperous young American Mormon family. The implied reader, it seems, needs to be convinced that people from other cultures are just like us. The church news also frequently prints missionary experiences. The implied reader is encouraged to view all contacts with non-members as potential conversion experiences, which may partially account for his reluctance to step outside the subculture. This people, now modeled as it is on People and other celebrity magazines that traditionally sell in grocery store checkout stands, is essentially female discourse also. The regular columns, as in the Ensign and Church News, have to do with homemaking and family, and even the book reviewed is essentially a woman's book. The practical utilitarian bent of both the Ensign and This People is reinforced graphically in these publications, where illustrations, however sophisticated in design and technique, are almost exclusively representational. They illustrate the content, picturing it for the reader. Ordinarily, the art and photographs do not invite speculation or stimulate the imagination. This People's reader is an upwardly mobile, success-oriented, but loyal church member, or is married to such a person. Although individual real readers, as evidenced in the letters to the editors, sometimes complain about lack of focus on ordinary people, the idealistic implied reader is more interested in Mormon celebrities. She wants to know how these people have achieved success while balancing family and church commitments. This People's implied reader, because she is success-oriented and educated, is more tolerant of non-traditional lifestyles. The women featured are not exclusively homemakers. An artist lives and works in a converted ward chapel. This reader, like the church news reader, is proud of the accomplishments of church members and derives some sense of self-worth from her vicarious association with successful Mormons. She is more aware of and involved in the outside world than her Ensign counterpart, and she is educated and interested in the arts, although she would not be called a scholar or an intellectual. Although the church per se is not much discussed in This People, the reader is assumed to be strongly family-centered and to enjoy the communal church setting. Any criticism of or deviation from church norms is guarded and cautious, and you might see, for example, Ed Fron's comments on the church's relationship with artists. He ventures a couple of statements that border on being critical, but they're very guarded. Exponent 2's implied reader is educated, well-read, and obviously female. She is a faithful participating church member, but is tolerant of those who are not, and of those who lead non-traditional lives. Exponent 2's implied reader believes women can combine family and career or education, that men should share household responsibilities, and that women may and ought to receive the priesthood. The Exponent 2 reader has a sense of humor, but it is perhaps a bit sardonic. Most humorous pieces published in Exponent 2 are satiric descriptions of traditional Mormon women, Patty Perfect or the Sunday Marathon. The Exponent 2 reader is a bit defensive and feels threatened or attacked by church leaders, church congregations, and more, quote, traditional women, even though she herself is at least a part-time housewife with children. She is a talented woman frustrated at female lack of power and input in the church setting and at her own lack of complete fulfillment in the home. She is willing to discuss sexual matters openly, but she is not, in fact, an especially radical feminist. The graphics, for instance, vary between a fairly sophisticated impressionistic style and a traditionally feminine hearts and flowers style, which could occasionally even be called cutesy. Judging particularly from its advertisements, Sunstone's implied reader appears to be a Mormon yuppie. His age is between 25 and 35. He lives in the Salt Lake area or in another American city or university town. He is at least college educated, middle or upper class, and likely a professional. While he is a church member, he feels slightly uncomfortable in the communal church setting, even though he may achieve success in that setting. He is especially sensitive to the impact of church teachings on gender identity. This issue runs two articles on sex stereotyping in church lesson manuals. I am using he, in fact, as a grammatical convenience. The implied reader of Sunstone could be either male or female. The magazine has features of both male and female discourse. The key thing, however, is that the Sunstone reader prides him or herself on being non-sexist. Sunstone's implied reader's relationship to the outside world is more friendly than the official church publications. He is not threatened by media criticism of the church, in fact, rejoices in it if he agrees with it, and he is open to input from people of other faiths and recognizes the RLDS Church as a brother organization. While more outwardly oriented than the readers of some of the publications, the Sunstone reader still focuses a great deal of energy on the church and his troubled relationship to it. A look at the graphics and the attention-getting titles and kickers also leads to the conclusion that Sunstone's implied reader is somewhat combative and relishes the controversial. The cover design for this particular issue particularly contributes to that impression. I mean, even the colors. So if you look at the whole thing, I guess I'm wearing the same colors. What does that say about me today? But And also, listen to the list of words and phrases from the titles and subtitles listed in the table of contents. Conscientious objector, militarism, familyolatry, priesthood prescription for women, insane, gay, defamation suit, provoke, mystery, violence, and sex. Of course, this playing up of the sensational and controversial is characteristic of a magazine that sells on the newsstand and is aimed at catching a reader's attention. But it offers a definite contrast to the more sedate format of Dialogue, even though the two magazines often overlap in the issues discussed and in approach. Now, the implied reader of Dialogue is in some ways very much like the Sunstone reader, possibly a slightly older and more mellow version of the combative Mormon yuppie implied in Sunstone. Dialogue's cover art, for instance, is also non-representational and modern, but it draws less attention to itself than Sunstone's flashier design. The titles in the table of contents are milder and more matter-of-fact, implying that the reader has an inherent interest in the magazine's contents and does not need to be grabbed or flattered into reading. Dialogue's academic journal format and style is a typically male discourse. However, perhaps because of competition with Sunstone for readership, Dialogue does not hold strictly to this heavily male discourse, but also includes feature-like pieces, sometimes adds a personal touch to scholarly articles, as in Michael Quinn's polygamy article, and frequently runs articles addressing women's issues. Even though the format and titles of Dialogue are relatively bland, however, the issues addressed in the interior of the magazine are not. Dialogue's implied reader, the most highly educated of the readers I am discussing, is, of course, tolerant of divergence from conventional church beliefs, is renowned for this attitude, in fact, hence its naughty reputation among many Mormons who have never even seen a copy of the magazine. The Dialogue reader is willing to consider with an open mind evidence that is even potentially damaging to the church. He, like the Sunstone reader, is rather scornful of those who cling to what Michael Quinn calls historical fantasy. He also feels some condescension toward the less intelligent and advantage, a feeling Robert Egbert explores in a reading group, but he's also tinged with guilt for that feeling. Dialogue's reader is a serious reader interested in scholarship. He is not a casual reader picking up a magazine for entertainment or a little stimulation. Although the lengthiness of Quinn's article, for instance, is not typical, it is still assumed by the text that the reader is one who will stick with 100 pages of detailed history. A more casual reader would give up after 20 pages or so, if not less. Dialogue's reader, even more than Sunstone's, is interested in history and the early church, preferring it, in fact, to the modern church. Now, it is important to note in discussing the implied readers of these publications that my readings and conclusions are my own constructions, my own interpretations. Every reader makes his or own construction instinctively as he or she reads, and each construction will be different as each reader is. In outlining these conclusions, I have set myself up as an informed reader, but even informed readers often disagree radically on interpretations, otherwise most critics would be out of work. Any actual reader has a perfect right to disagree with any or all of the specifics of my readings, and I welcome additional insights. Some of the details of my readings may also seem obvious or trite. That is because of the intuitive constructions each of us have already made as we have read these publications in the past. The real purpose of this discussion, though, is rather to introduce a process, a way of reading that considers not only the content of a text and the intent of the author or editor, but also the expectations and assumptions of the text regarding its reader. Recognizing the implicit presence of these expectations and assumptions can sometimes explain readers' responses in a way other approaches can't. In the example I gave earlier of Bellows Henderson the Rain King, I, as a female reader, was unable to successfully enter the world of the book whose implied reader was male. This, I think, often happens to actual readers confronting church and quasi-church publications. An actual reader who considers himself or herself to be an intellectual, who is open-minded toward ambiguity, enjoys critical discussion, sees a wide separation between the institutional church and the principles of the gospel, and prefers the early church to the contemporary one, may experience difficulties approaching the ensign, whose implied reader profile is quite different. If he can temporarily suspend his own stronger beliefs and thinking processes and become the implied reader for the duration of his reading, he may feel the inspiration intended by the editors and writers and enjoy his reading. Through becoming that implied reader, he may even gain increased understanding of actual readers who more closely resemble that implied reader, like the male reader of a feminist text does, for instance. If, however, he is so different from the implied reader that he is unable to overcome it, even to become it, even temporarily, he will experience some sense of isolation or detachment from the text. If he feels the same detachment in the institutional church setting of meetings and activities, the experience of attempting to read the ensign may underscore that feeling and contribute to his sense of himself as an outsider. Aligns himself with the implied reader of the Ensign or Church News may experience similar difficulty approaching Sunstone or Dialogue. He or she may either temporarily suspend belief and gain increased understanding of those who subscribe to such views and publications, or he or she may be unable to suspend belief and will also feel alien, outside, and detached. These feelings could in turn lead to shock and hostility, just as the Sunstone Dialogues reader's feelings of exclusion may turn to scorn or condescension. Such negative feelings are, I believe, a defense against the frightening, disturbing feelings of isolation and detachment. Actual readers theoretically could avoid such negative reactions if they understand the process at work in their own minds and hearts as they work at the communication process through the medium of published writings about the church, its doctrines, practices, and members. Now, that's the end of my paper and the end of my time, too. And I just have one little note that I want to add. Is that all right? It's not very long. That came to me as I was working on the paper, and that is that people kept asking me, well, how do you feel about this? And what do you really find out? And one observation that kept coming back and back to me is that the main difference between these publications is an educational level. The Sunstone Dialogue and Exponent 2 readers had a more sophisticated vocabulary, they understood more unexplained cultural allusions, they had a higher level of literary competence, they had a more trained and logical way of approaching the belief system. All of these abilities are related primarily to educational experience, and I might add a liberal arts educational experience. They are not related particularly to economic level, radical ideas, or strength of testimony. The economic level of the Ensign reader and these readers was very similar, for example. And if we can extend the concept of the implied reader to view the Ensign implied reader as the ideal or intended church member that's envisioned by church administrators and leaders, we could conclude that the institutional church prefers and favors those members who are not as educated, at least those who are educated in technical or practical fields rather than the liberal arts, which I find somewhat ironic for a church which boasts of its emphasis on education. And according to this analysis, it seems that what the church wants is, again, the member with a practical education, further reinforcing the celebrated pragmatic utilitarian bent of the contemporary Mormon church. And what this implies for the intelligent thinking member who has followed church encouragement to gain further education and exercise his own talents, I find a little disheartening. Thank you.
I wanted to respond to Doris's paper as a writer, as a reader, and as a freshman English teacher. may seem a little strange, but after having taught freshmen for 25 years and giving them an essay to read and then come back to class and discuss it with them and try to understand their understanding of the essay, it's sometimes a little frightening. I do have a little problem with the paper's definition of the implied reader, who is, quote, a construct of characteristics encoded within a text, close quote, and who has, quote, a given set of characteristics, attitudes, and presuppositions, which is relatively stable, close quote, or to give another definition quoted from Daniel Wilson, the implied reader is, quote, the behavior, attitudes, and background necessary for a proper understanding of the text. In other words, what the text assumes about the knowledge, beliefs, and abilities of its implied reader. The implied reader is not the real reader of the magazine, the reader the editor considers in making his editorial decisions about what will appear in his publication, close quote. This real reader, quote, creates the text, but the text itself still contains an implied reader separate from those real readers, close quote. The implied reader may, however, be very similar to the real reader, according to the paper, quote, but occasionally the implied reader perceivable in the text differs from the reader the editor and writer think they are writing for. Thus, being able to identify the implied reader encoded in a text could be useful to an editor or writer as well as to the reader approaching the text, close quote. Of course, the editors and writers don't create this real reader. The real reader is there to be pleased and, if necessary, cajoled. But the implied reader, as defined earlier, is created in poems, essays, novels, stories, or in a whole magazine or periodical. But who creates the implied reader? Who is, quote, a construct of characteristics encoded within a text, close quote, which neither the author or editor can be quite sure of, and for what purpose is this reader created? And another question, is this implied reader intentional or accidental? I know about the real reader, for I've spent years trying with varying degrees of success to please this person, and I'm a real reader myself, seeking to be pleased, but I've never really thought much about the implied reader or taking on the role of the implied reader. It's a very interesting concept, particularly if this implied reader is beyond the control of both the editor and the writer, an addition to both what both intended. Because editors are very careful about the arranging their magazines to please a given reader, this implied reader seems to me to be almost subversive. Someone inside the magazine that who got there who can't be controlled. And also, he might reveal things about the editor or the institution, which perhaps the editor or institution sponsoring the magazine didn't want to be revealed. Yet, however unintended this implied reader, he or she controls us somewhat as real readers, for, quote, when an actual reader approaches a given text, he sheds some of his own attitudes and characteristics and theoretically selects only those which will enable him to become temporarily the implied reader, the reader implied or intended by the text, close quote. And if the real reader can't do that, quote, he will likely feel uncomfortable reading the text, experiencing lack of understanding and or of identification, rather than being drawn into the text. He will remain outside. And there, close quote, and there are other consequences. I have never consciously taken on the role of an implied reader, for I didn't know there was one or that I should become one, although I have done it, I may have done it unconsciously. And I should like to see both the conscious and unconscious experience discussed in more detail. It might help to make more books readable for me and for other readers, and for a lot of other readers. It undoubtedly has something to do with why we like or don't like a novel, story, poem, etc. Can't get into a book, can't really appreciate or understand what other real readers seem to be to do very readily. I would like to know more about the implied reader. Particularly, I would like to know who creates this reader and why, or if the implied reader is really a kind of useful literary accident. So I think this implied reader needs to be more carefully defined here. But the idea is certainly an intriguing one, and in the balance of the paper, we look at the implied reader in one issue each of the Ends and Church News, This People, Exponent 2, Sunstone, and Dialogue. I would like to have had BYU Studies and BYU Today included, simply for my own interest. I really wondered about the implied reader in those two publications. I thought I saw Ed Geary here, who was the editor of BYU Studies. Studying only one issue of each of the publications seems a rather narrow view, unless one assumes that every issue of each is always typical. I would have liked an in-depth study of the implied reader in one. I would prefer the Ensign, or perhaps Sunstone, or perhaps a comparison-contrast study of the two in some depth, and perhaps a brief description of the implied reader in the other publications. This, I think, would have resulted in more convincing proof of the presence of the implied reader in these publications than does the one-issue survey. It's a purely inductive process, and we, I think, need more than one example of each magazine. The study of the implied reader in these magazines concerns the language, repeat for a moment, concerns the language of the implied reader, the reader's understanding of cultural codes, the literary competence, the ability to read, the reader's belief system, and the reader's mindset. Is the reader objective, cynical, inquisitive, optimistic, so on? And then I'd like to look at these, to Doris's comments about these implied readers and respond. To summarize, the implied reader of the Ensign is female. She approaches text straightforwardly, accepts what she reads as fact, as face value. Her attention needs to be caught, for she is essentially a non-reader, to quote, too busy or not interested in reading that is not immediately useful or perhaps inspirational. She has a sense of humor, is middle or upper class, family-centered. Her major interest is the church. She gives service. She has, quote, a little relationship to the outside, larger world, which is seen as the enemy. I wonder if the Ensign's editorial staff knows their implied reader is female. My guess is they don't. As Doris said in her paper, the implied reader and the real reader are very similar, but there can be differences. And it seems to me that if the Ensign staff has in fact decided that their reader is female and directs their magazine to the female reader, they're doing something contrary to the purpose of the church or the magazine, and somebody better tell them about it. This doesn't mean that they haven't done it. The reader seems to me, as I read the Ensign, to be adult male, female, both single and married, although the emphasis is on married adults with a family. The long articles on marriage, relationships, problems, the problems of the aging, divorce, etc., suggest this. The long articles on church history and doctrine, biblical history, foreign culture, some of which are fairly demanding, also suggest a reader who is either male or female and who can read. I follow the Ensign quite carefully, and particularly earlier issues, and it seems years, and it seems to me they're working very hard to create a magazine that has a somewhat broader appeal than the paper suggests. I would like more evidence that the Ensign implied reader is a somewhat non-thinking, non-reading, wholly practical, frightened female. I don't think the reader is. I'm being a little bit selective in my modifiers here. Maybe. But I think a careful study of, say, 2 or 3 years of the Ensign might reveal a somewhat different implied reader, a somewhat more cosmopolitan, mature reader. The Church News reader is similar to the Ensign. Quote, he or she is on a slightly lower economic level, has less experience with the Church, has a shorter attention span, is a little less educated, and is perhaps even more conventional, close quote. Of course, the Church News is a newspaper and follows a newspaper for reading, appeal to a lot of people at various levels, report rather than editorializing, except for the one editorial, which very often disturbs a lot of people, or used to. Not so much anymore. Quote, the implied reader is encouraged to view all contacts with non-members as potential conversion experiences, which may account partially for his reluctance to step outside the subculture, close quote. The news encourages missionary work, and given the missionary program of the Church, that would seem necessary. Certainly it should come as no surprise, but I don't see the implied reader as essentially female. The articles don't seem to me to have that particular bias, but perhaps a careful in-depth analysis would reveal that the implied reader is female after all. Again, the Church News better start paying attention to the implied reader. This People's Discourse is also, quote, essentially female. This is a magazine I don't really know, although I've glanced through it every issue. My impression is that the magazine's primary concern is successful Mormons, male and female, and their lifestyle. In other words, the gospel really does pay off. Look, we can prove it. This is how you can live, too, or if you don't live this kind of life, you can dream about it or pray for it. That's the feeling I get. I'm surprised every bishop doesn't carry a copy under his arm. But the success they describe isn't essentially female success or success that would interest females primarily. The advertising alone suggests it's the luxury houses, the luxury cars, the luxury vacations, the restaurants, so on. The analysis of the Exponent 2's implied reader, except that the implied reader wants the priesthood, seems accurate to me. Well-educated, well-bred, or sorry, well-educated, well-read, slight Freudian slip, female, faithful but tolerant, able to combine career with family, wants husband to share household life, sense of humor, talented, frustrated, lack of power but not radical, frustrated, own lack of complete fulfillment in the home, and willing to discuss sexual matters. I like that particularly. However, I would add creative. The implied reader of the Exponent 2 isn't trapped by her life. She moves. Or if she is trapped, she is expected to change things and to use the doctrine organization of the Church and her own faith and intelligence to help her do that. The reader is also very loyal to and very proud of her pioneer sisters. She senses a loss today that women in the pioneer church were stronger than she is in some ways, more at the center of things, more respected and more powerful, and were more familiar with the terms prophetess, priestess, heavenly mother, and sisterhood. And what the reader of Exponents 2 wants is not the priesthood, but it has something to do with these four terms. She hasn't defined this need completely, but she is working on it. I find Exponent 2 in some ways the most interesting magazine or periodical, and I think there's a kind of sense of power being generated, a search that publication suggests. The picture of Sunstone's reader also seems quite accurate. Mormon yuppie, 25 to 35, male and female, college educated, middle or upper middle class, professional, slightly uncomfortable, church member, concerned about gender identity, friendly relationship to the outside world, outwardly oriented but still focused a lot of energy on church. My parallelism here isn't very good. I gave it up. And his or her trouble with it. Competitive, likes controversy, likes to play up the sensational and controversial. To this I would add a search for a rationale to do what the church doesn't approve. I don't know how many Sunstone readers we have here. A desire to break loose from old restraints and live a much freer lifestyle without payment or regret. To break loose from authority and doctrine, or at least interpret it in some new way to make it more fun. Or life more fun. To be a guilt-free spiritual swinger, I think, some respect. And Sunstone, too, is more of a badge than the other publications. Readers of Sunstone tend to identify each other as Sunstone readers, and Sunstone writers are also known more as Sunstone writers than they are, say, Dialogue or Exponent 2 writers. There's a kind of a group feeling there. Dialogue. I remember buying my first issue at the BYU bookstore and walking dazed across the quadrangles. Dazed across the quadrangles to my office, joyful at last that there was dialogue. And now the decades have passed, I think two, or three, and I can only assume I am an implied reader, the most highly educated of the readers, tolerant of divergent beliefs in the conventional church, willing to be open-minded about evidence, potentially damaging to the church, to be scornful about historical fantasy, guiltily condescending to the less intelligent and less advantaged, and an in-depth reader interested in scholarship. It's quite a pleasing picture. I don't mind it at all. However, I don't see myself as more interested in history and the early church, or preferring the early church to the present. I am, in fact, as an implied dialogue reader, fascinated by the modern church and all its trappings, and the questions of its power, commercial, political, religious, and how well it works. And I'm rather pleased. It seems to be working reasonably well. I'm proud of it. It works pretty well. I'm also set in my ways, established, unlikely to change much for all my intellectual curiosity, and I like to be comfortable. And I want my grandchildren, my wife's going to laugh, to be, we don't have any. Our youngest child is 1 year old. And I want my grandchildren to be good members, go on missions, get married in the temple, work hard, raise solid families, keep hope and faith, and be happy and gain exaltation. I sense that as you move from the Sunstone crowd up to the dialogue group, and maybe from there you go to BYU Studies, but that you tend to come back into the fold, because after all the fold has a fence around it and you're safe there and nobody's going to steal your houses, your apartments, or your Cadillac. After the discussion of the six periodicals, the paper concludes, quote, "The real purpose of this discussion is to introduce a process, a way of reading that considers not only the content of a text and the intent of the author-editor, but also the expectations and assumptions of the text regarding its reader," close quote. In other words, the purpose is to help the real reader, that is this understanding of the implied reader, in other words, the purpose is to help the real reader add a new dimension to his reading. And he or she does this by accepting the identity of the implied reader, although the editors and the writers may not have created that implied reader intentionally, and thereby understanding and enjoying the text in a way otherwise not possible. This would give the reader the possibility of enjoying and understanding a whole range of periodicals discussed here. It's an idea worth thought. Reading and the development of one's ability as a reader are a lifelong pursuit. Perhaps the really skilled reader doesn't become more and more discriminating, less and less tolerant of what he doesn't like, but comes in time to be able to read virtually anything, to become truly spiritually and intellectually cosmopolitan. I'd like to compliment Doris on her paper. I think it's a very interesting study and suggests some genuine possibilities both for the editors of these various periodicals, but also for us as readers as we learn to read virtually everything and to be able to feel it and to become a part of what's intended in the periodicals. Thank you.
We have about 10 minutes for questions. If you have any questions, you can direct them to either Doris or Doug or to both. Yes. You're exactly right. And that's what I was trying to do in looking at the implied reader, was to see who the magazine was addressed to, and then try it so that we could sort of, Scott Dunn suggested yesterday I should make it a quiz and say, this is the implied reader, so that you could match up and see how well you match up. I have to be really confident about my generalizations about the implied readers, but I think it's always true that there are many different kinds of people reading any text. I mean, whether it's a novel or a children's book or a short story or a newspaper, there are potentially millions of different kinds of people reading. And oftentimes, even the majority of the people are not who's the same as that implied reader. And that's what I wanted to look at, is what assumptions. Now, I've read the Anson for most of my life. I might say how I got interested in doing this paper. Last summer, I had a baby, and I was kind of ill, and I stayed home from church for quite a few weeks, and I thought, well, one Sunday I decided maybe I should do something churchy while I'm home, and so I got on Anson and read it from cover to cover and in one sitting, and I've never done that before. And it was really an interesting experience, because if you read a paragraph here and an article here, and, look at the pictures and the illustrations here and read them at different sittings, you don't get the same feeling you get when you read the whole publication. And I began to think,
Who do they think I am? You know, one specific example. In that issue that I read, there were three major references to families who had been advised not to have children, any more children, for medical reasons, after they already had a number of children. And they had gone ahead and had children, and they were all handicapped. And then the magazine talked about all the wonderful things that had happened and the growth they had experienced from these handicapped children. And there were three different references, two stories that were related to that and another reference. And I thought, I never would have picked that up without reading it in one sitting. And for me personally, at that point, having been advised medically not to have any more children and pretty much decided not to, I thought, now my values are conflicting with the values that they assume I hold. And I began to think, how many values are presented and how many assumptions are made about us that we may or may not agree with. And I thought it might be useful to begin to look at, see if we could find a way to identify what those assumptions were to see if we do match up. And most of the time we don't match up with all of them. And we may match up with some or not very many, but you know, you're absolutely right. When you see a readership survey, it's going to give an entirely different profile than the kind of profile that I've given. And the profile I've given, you know, isn't necessarily, well, I'm a little uncomfortable saying it's stable and set too, because it isn't, because the implied reader is an interpretive construct like every other part of reading. And I mean, it's only theoretically stable, you know, like Plato's ideal. It's because in real life it isn't. And so, you know, you might, that's the hard thing, is that anybody might make an implied reader that would match more closely to them. That one thing I really worried about was I trying to make an implied reader that matched me in the ones that I liked and match people that I didn't like in the ones that I don't like. And so I tried to be careful about that. So. I think, well, of course, most of people never heard of the implied reader. But I think that what happens with any editor is that they do what I did in approaching their publication, intuitively probably, or they may do it partially consciously. They may do readership surveys, as Sunstone did, to try and get a picture, to try and match up their intuitive implied reader with the real readers and make them closer together. And I think the Ensign, like you say, it's harder to tie down, and their editorship changes frequently, and their and the issues they discuss change, and I think you're right, it's probably less stable than the others. But I think the process is the same, that when an editor goes to make editorial decisions, he or she makes them on the basis of this picture they have in their head of what the reader is. That's well, yeah, the implied reader is a real slippery concept. I've really been grappling with myself, because it's a term, it's a theoretical term that kind of slips around.
In the editor's
subconscious. Yeah.
Isn't it a fact that Douglas is confused on that?
Well, yeah, and there, you know, yeah, and some people, I mean, narrative theory, that's what narrative theory is, people arguing about things like that and what you're going to call them, because there's somebody else is called the intended reader. And the intended reader is the one that the author intends, and thinks he's writing to, and the actual reader is the one who really reads it, and the implied reader is the one that, as Doug says, sort of magically appears out of the text with Venus. And I don't know that the technical distinctions make that much difference, because what you said, I think, is the key. The distinction I'm interested in making is the distinction between what's in there, whoever put it there, and all of us who are all individuals approaching the text differently. And that's the distinction I'm interested in making. And, you know, theoretically, where it comes from, it's a slippery, tricky problem that, like philosophy, that people argue over a lot. And I'm not real good at explaining it, but I hope that you get the basic distinction between readers who are inside the text and readers who are, you know, picking it up and reading it, you know, as Wayne Booth put it, the self that I am that goes about, that fixes leaky faucets and argues with my kids is not the same self that's reading the Ensign. I put off some of those characteristics partially, and that's the distinction I'm trying to make between the one that the reader and the real person.
The implied reader, I mean, seems to me that a writer obviously tries to control how his reader is going to respond. A good writer can do that, but no writer can do it totally or absolutely, and no editor can control what he's going to say totally and absolutely to his readers. It's that lack of uncontrol, it seems to me, that we get the implied reader, who in many instances may be a truer picture than the real reader. Because you have all of these people writing, and no editor, as hard as they might try, can control all the writers and all the advertising and all the layout. It's a kind of...
Are we just talking about rhetoric?
Rhetoric? Well, let's not start talking about rhetoric. It's a historical problem. There's no doubt about that. Well, what I'm interested in is what Doris has done. I mean, it gives us a whole new... Well, it's not new, obviously, but it applied to the church publications. It begins to give us some new understandings and new truths we don't have. Or maybe not truth, but at least some insight.
I'm sorry to be the one to have to cut this interesting discussion off, but we are out of time. I'd like to thank you for coming and thank Doug and Doris for their most interesting papers. Thank you.